Accession number 16427, Major Thomas Ward, Reel 11.
Major Ward, Reel 11. You were saying that General Montgomery did something important as soon as he arrived.
Yes. He examined the position of Army headquarters in relation to the Desert Air Force headquarters, which were then 20 miles apart. His immediate reaction was to say, these must be side by side, both headquarters. The Desert Air Force and the 8th Army are going to fight this battle in close support together. Now at this stage, I was promoted to Major, left the South African wing, with regret I might say, but pleased to be moving on, and went, as I've mentioned, to Morrow, M-O-R-U.
Mobile Operations Room Unit.
That's right. Well, that was their forward operations unit, where the commander, which was Wing Commander Lewis, operated and controlled all the fighter bomber squadrons and the medium bombers like the Bostons and the Baltimores. I was to report to him as I'd been appointed senior air liaison officer, 8th Army. And help to develop this close cooperation in the future. I had a period with this headquarters before the battle started on the 23rd of October 1942, which gave me time to get used to the communications, used to the close contact with all the Air Force, and also to recruit new ALOs and get them established at every squadron and every wing in the Desert Air Force, because they were under my command.
What sort of qualities did you look for in these ALOs that you recruited?
Well, I actually didn't actually make all the selections, because it was a big job, and of course Army headquarters had this to do, because they'd appointed me to do this important job, and they also had of course knew who had been on the course at Tel Aviv in the meantime following me, and so they were, if you like, as nearly as prepared as I was to do such a job. And this was absolutely splendid, because I knew several of them, and I was delighted that we were going to work together in the future. Now, when the battle started, we had our briefings, of course, from the airport, what point of view. We had to keep the Germans quiet. It was then that it was important to keep in very close touch with Army headquarters and watch for German movements, as well as knowing where to bomb the Germans to stop the supplies coming in, and also to use the fighter bombers now in closer support. But this was very new to the Air Force, using the fighter bombers. This was using the Spitfires, the Kitty Hawks and the Hurricanes, armed with 500-pound bomb, a 500-pound bomb. This was very new. So there was no question of getting these people in the air without a target, but they would have a task of keeping certain areas quiet. If there was artillery to bomb, or if there was a leaguer of tanks to bomb, and that kind of thing.
So they would go for targets of opportunity.
That's what the fighters would. But their main task at this very moment was to keep the air clear of German aircraft, which they managed to do, which was splendid. Now that was really a great asset with this battle. If we could stop the German aircraft interfering with our troops when we attacked. Now, part of the reason why they'd achieved air superiority during the last 3 months was the fact that, partly was that the aircraft were not receiving their fuel and supplies. And well done, the Navy. And also for other reasons. But and also the bombing of the airfields, which was continuous, really, and with good results. So by this time, we were vastly superior to the Germans in arms and men. But during this period of 3 or 4 months, there'd been a lot of minefields laid by the Germans, a lot of digging in. They were going to be very difficult to move. And it did, in fact, take 10 days before our tanks were able to finally go through his minefields and spread out and follow the retreating German vehicles and tanks. And during that period, I think I'm right in saying our casualties were 13,000, which of course was very sad indeed, but I think everybody knew that there has to be severe losses if we were going to break out, because Germans had got very well established, and so had we. We stopped him going to Egypt, and he had to be moved from where he was, and we had to start clearing the Western Desert, Cyrenaica and Tunisia of Germans. That was our task. Now that was to take quite a long time after we'd broken out, and we knew where he would probably stop and stand and hope to. We were advancing now, he was retreating. I didn't mention that during the period when we were at El Alamein, we lost Tobruk, couldn't maintain it. So the Germans had the advantage of that port. That was the trouble. But by another task for the Air Force was to stop the Germans using the port of Tobruk. And so the Navy did that as well, because that was a useful port for the German supplies.
When you were flying missions over during the build-up, preparation for Alamein, were your aircraft able to spot minefields by observation or by a photograph?
Not really, not from the air. It came out in photographs. There was a lot of photographing during this period, and of course there was a complete mosaic of photographs of the German lines. Now, I really didn't see a lot of that, but they had experts on that job. And one thing I should mention is that tell that we had complete, almost complete air superiority, but just in case we didn't, Montgomery decided that he would move, I think it was 10 corps, forward to the forward line, near the forward lines, in reserve. But he didn't want the Germans to know that. So they built dummy tanks in there where, and left them there where they were before, and moved them at night. And hopefully the German reconnaissance plane didn't spot that. They camouflaged these dummies as the tanks were camouflaged, and they made it, if possible, look the same. And so the Germans wouldn't appreciate that a whole tank regiment or another units had been moved forward, because that would have given the give them the idea that an attack at El Alamein was imminent.
Could you help out by checking on the authenticity of that sort of deception?
I've read about it in the past, in the you know, since the war, and I think it was. I got the impression that the result was pleasing. Because it didn't matter once we got broken through. Mm. Mm.
How was the Moru actually organised and equipped and set up and staffed?
There was an operation unit where they plotted aircraft movement, as they did in the Battle of Britain, you know, where they plotted aircraft coming over the coast and our fighters going up and so on, and controlled it from there, and in a similar way. And then I was part of the that unit in a section where I fed them with information from the army point of view, and also I was almost side by side with the commander, Lewis, and in fact we had our photographs taken together, and it was in the local magazine, which I have in my records here. And there in that photograph was Major McGregor from the South African Air Force, and also and the liaison officer from the American Air Force, I remember, yes, the American Air Force, although they were not involved at that very time. I suppose it was to watch their equipment coming in.
So in this operations room, would this be a room in under canvas?
It was in a vehicle.
In a vehicle.
Big vehicle. But enlarged and enlarged with canopies and things.
With penthouses on either side.
Yes. And vehicles actually backed into it and on either side. So we had extensions, you know, and a big.
Was the plotting done on vertical maps with Chinagraph or on a table with?
It was on a table, yes, on horizontal table, yes. But also there were maps all around the and which there were the staff keeping them up to date.
How many staff roughly looking at them, looking after the maps on the table?
These were RAF.
Plotters, presumably.
Plotters, and yes, well, probably. I mean, there were quite a lot. They worked in shifts, and now by this time I had two ALOs with me, and I got my VHF very high frequencies sets in vehicles, three of them. So I was in communication with aircraft. Eventually, not now. We were not briefing pilots, not the ALOs, not yet. But this was to come, which I'll tell you about later. But this was in the pipeline, and I knew about it, and we were thinking about it all the time and how best to do it. The forward troops were about passing Tobruk. We'd recaptured Tobruk. That was great because our supplies could come in there. And it was at that time that it was suggested that I should go to Kenya. To tell the pilots who were training for the Desert Air Force all about the El Alamein battle and also the war generally in the Western Desert. I was very pleased about this and regarded it as an honour to represent the 8th Army going down there, because I was going to be the officer who was going to do this job. I went to Cairo and I was told to report to a flying boat which was moored on the River Nile. I got on this and I think there were about a dozen passengers, and we flew up the Nile. We flew at, I should think, 200 or 300 feet over the crocodiles in the rivers, and all the way to we had stops, but all the way to Lake Victoria in Kenya. From there, I was told to go to Nairobi Airport, where I'd get a plane and she would take me to Nakuru, which was 6,000 feet up from the sea level. There at Nakuru was a South African and Rhodesian, really, Air Force station. There was they were seemed to be in charge of this, but also RAF. But there were South African pilots training, South African instructors, including, and also there were RAF instructors teaching them to fly, and there were also instructors from Rhodesia and so on. Now, when I arrived, they were expecting me, but they didn't know why I was going. So they said, "What do you want?" I said, "I've come to tell you about the army, the 8th Army, in now famous in the Western Desert." "Well, what do you want then?" I said, "I want a nice lecture room with all the maps I require, and assistance in operating probably projectors and that kind of thing. And then I want to sit down and arrange a program of instruction and do this daily." They were full of cooperation. It soon settled down into a very useful briefing session for these pilots. And of course they kept, well, I was there 2.5 months, I think.
Were you doing the same briefing every day, or did you vary it?
I varied it a bit. Actually, I'd got used to talking to a class at the we'd had occasionally well, I think the only so far the only really training I didn't have any training of taking classes or anything. I just started doing it with the ALOs and before I left and that kind of thing, you know. So it was fairly new to me, but everything is new as you go along when it keeps changing. And soon settled down in... I realised how much interest there was, because they didn't know very much about it.
Didn't know about operational conditions? And
no. They asked a lot of questions. They were going up there shortly.
What interested them most?
What's the climate like? How do you cope with all the sand? And then I gradually they realised that information on the army was interesting, particularly if they were going to be in close support. I told them about Montgomery's initial speech about the army headquarters and the RAF headquarters coming together after being 20 miles apart. I said that was a good start. Going from there, told them about my arrival at Morrow and the network of ALOs we had. So I said, "At your squadron, your wing, we'll have army representatives who will keep you informed on what is happening in the army." So they were very interested in this and realised that they were getting some useful information. And then, of course, I met them all in the mess in the evening and at the sundowner and so on. Also met them later on in the Western Desert, because I went back.
Continuity.
Continuity. And for me it was, a nice rest from the desert. Because we'd been in the desert for quite a long time.
How did you cope with all the sand and the other conditions in the desert?
I've never been so fit in all my life. Never. It was hot during the day, but it was cool and cold during the night, believe it or not. From El Alamein, which was 60 miles from Alexandria, believe it or not, we used to go into Alexandria for a bath on an evening and come back. Only once got lost, because you must appreciate if you get off the main road in the desert, you rely on petrol tins and barrels
to mark it.
To mark this and that. Now then, we were fairly static where I was in the waiting for El Alamein to start. So we knew where we were, and we knew each petrol can or barrel on the way to the main road, which is quite a long way away, really. But one night we came back from Alexandria about midnight, couldn't find our camp. Next morning we went to sleep it was in a jeep, jolly cold, had a few naps in the jeep. First light came, we're only a few hundred yards from there. But you know, the desert's the desert. It's got to have a few guides in drums and things like that that we manage. But yes, to enjoy our trips to Alexandria.
What could you do in Alexandria besides having a bath?
Oh well, you could go to a restaurant and have a good meal. We did actually get to know family and went there for a bath, and kept in touch with them after the war. But they were conscious that we were going to be in a terrible battle which faced us and so on. So they were very pleased to give us a meal or whatever, but it was mainly a hot bath, which was great.
When you were operating in the Moro, did you have a shift system to man it 24 hours a day?
We had somebody on duty, yes, but usually not necessarily awake all the time. Somebody from the operations room would waken us up in case of emergency.
So you would be duty officer, but you wouldn't have to actually be awake and in the
room? Well, not during the static period. But yes, during the battle, yes, a little sleep sometimes.
Just men continuously.
Mm-hmm. But so later on we'll talk about this, because when I talk about cab ranks and fighter bombers, that was...
When you came back from Kenya to Moru, have there been any changes while you've been away?
No. Actually, I got back just in time for the Battle of Marath. I flew back from Kenya, from Nairobi to Khartoum, stayed a night there, where there were a terrible lot of mosquitoes, but we'd slept under mosquito nets. Then I flew to Cairo from there, and then from Cairo flew out to the desert and to Moro, who are well advanced now in the desert, and planning the Battle of Marath, which was one of the major battles on the way to Tunisia.
So fortified line, wasn't it?
Fortified line. And there was the opportunity for it. Well, we were part of the scheme. That's why I was recalled, actually. We're part of the plans, which were very careful plans, the attack, the Battle of Marath. We were to close support that with fighter bombers. And that was really one of the major, first major efforts with a very close support.
How close was very close?
Well, I would think about 500 yards, the strafing on that. But we got closer in Italy, closer than that. Now, these pilots, as I've mentioned, and I'll mention many times in Italy when we get there, were the experts from the Battle of Britain. They were the leaders. They were the leading the strafing, and the close support. The others were following, and they were experienced, well-known squadron leaders and people like that. I admired them greatly, and Montgomery was happy because he'd got his close support.
Was he the main prime mover behind this idea of developing close support?
Absolutely. From the very beginning. But because there were they had a course in Tel Aviv, which I attended quite early. Obviously, they were planning it from England, this, wasn't it? And that was, foreseen. But he was, by putting the aircraft together. Lord Tedder was in command of the Desert Air Force at the time.
Did you see him?
Yes, now and again, yes.
What impression did he make on you?
A very quiet man, but a very nice man, but very experienced, and did a marvellous job.